Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them. And our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the North Carolina Legislature, it is Thursday, February 7th, 2018. This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Glad to have you along. State of the Union, controversy in the Commonwealth, and reporting from the heartland. Those are all fair topics on this edition of the pod. NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne is your guest this week. He joins us on the cell from Iowa. Don, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
You were in Iowa this week, all over the state, largely because of the State of the Union, chatting with voters. Your story that ran on NPR on Wednesday morning took place in Denison, Iowa. I had never heard of Denison, Iowa. Small town of about 9,000 in the western part of the state. I unexcitingly watched from my house. You watched with a group of Iowans. Set the scene for me.
I did, and I will tell you, Denison, for movie buffs out there, is the hometown of one Academy Award-winning actress, Donna Reed.
Wow.
She was Jimmy Stewart's wife, I believe, love interest wife, in It's a Wonderful Life. It's been a while since I've seen that movie. But, yeah, it's one of those small Iowa towns, and I was in the lounge that's attached to one of those kind of family restaurants, a restaurant that bills itself as the oldest restaurant in all of the state of Iowa. And there were about a dozen people there who were watching the State of the Union on the big screen in the corner, and they had braved single-digit temperatures to come out and drink cold Budweisers and watch the president. So that's kind of where I live my life, looking for scenes just like that where I can have conversations with people.
Tell me a little bit about the people who were there. Was it all white? Were they union workers? Were they middle-aged? Did anybody bring their kids? Who were the individuals who were before you?
It was a small sample, right? But yes, in this part of Iowa in particular, it's not a particularly diverse part of the state, so the population is overwhelmingly white. This group, this sample, happened to be all white, with one woman who is Latino, but it was a mix of mostly men, but there were women as well. The thing that made it a little unusual for the place, because this was in the district of Congressman Steve King, the very conservative, and of course, these days, not just these days, very controversial Congressman,
right.
Steve King. This was in his district, and more than half of the people there were Democrats. And as I found out, there's a small group of Democrats who gather at this place at some regular intervals, and they kind of talk politics and share some refreshments. But the owner of the place was also there, took a chair and watched. He was a Republican. A friend of one of the Democrats was there. He was a Republican. There was another Republican gentleman who pulled up. So it was, politically, it was mixed, but it skewed a little bit Democratic. In my story, I had a short piece, and I just focused on the comments of one Republican voter and one Democratic voter. But the response was absolutely predictable, in that people were responding based on their political beliefs. But the fact that they were there on a Tuesday night, when what passed kind of for the second polar vortex in a week had rolled through, told me that they're still engaged and that they're still paying attention and that they wanted to see what the president had to say.
So if it skewed Democratic, this audience that you were with on Tuesday night, there were plenty of conservatives, it sounded like. How did they engage with one another? I mean, was this like the old lunchroom where you get the football team sitting on one side and the members of the band sitting on another? Or were they mingling within the two groups?
Well, they were the Republican who I used in the story was a friend of one of the Democrats, and he was seated right at the table with the rest of them. And you would have, you know, from 5 feet away, kind of observing the table, you couldn't say, oh, there's the Republican, or that, you know, it was all a big kind of friendly group, and they were engaged in all kinds of different conversation. There was a Libertarian in that mix as well at that table. Earlier in the day, I think it's significant to note, I'd been at this this cafe for lunch, which is how I knew to come back later on in the day. There was what they call the big table in the dining room, and there were six women, all they looked like they were probably, you know, baby boomers. And I said, can I take a quick survey, ladies? I said, who's going to watch the State of the Union tonight? And only three of them said they were going to watch it. And then they kind of went around the table, and two of them were Democrats, and the other four were Republicans. And one of the ones who was going to watch it was one of the Democrats, and one of the ones who wasn't going to watch it was a Republican. And then there was a third who was kind of undecided as to whether or not she was going to watch it. But I was able to hear their conversation before I walked up and interrupted them so rudely. And they were talking about their families. They were talking about the local sports team. They were talking about something they saw on television last night. They weren't talking politics at all. And the thing that really struck me, and you do still find this in small town America, is when they told me that they were either pro-Trump or anti-Trump or voted for him or didn't, and whether or not they were going to watch that night, they were actually surprising one another with their political views. You know, one said, oh, I didn't know you didn't vote for him, or I didn't, you know, they, so it's like this was a group that had lunch there pretty regularly together, because it's the main place in town, and they weren't even intensely aware of one another's politics. And I don't know what it's like in the capital where you live, right. But I live in a capital city as right. Well, and everybody knows everybody's politics. And that was both really surprising to me, but also kind of comforting in a way, to just show that, you know, life goes on and that there are things more important to people.
Right. That's, to me, that sounds very refreshing. I generally speaking, you know, largely where people's politics fall and lie. All right, so Iowa, you've been in the Hawkeye State reporting. You were in Colorado prior to that. Your beat is very much the presidency and those who are running, who are going to run, who will continue to run for the White House. The Iowa caucuses, is now less than a year away. I looked at that earlier today. I couldn't believe that. Does it seem like we're inside of a year? And I guess just gauge for me where you're at in terms of a level of excitement versus anxiety and perceived exhaustion, perhaps.
It depends who you talk to. Okay. Again, this is anecdotal, because I'm walking up to people in diners and at VFW halls and union halls and the like. So I try to kind of apply what I learn and put it up against the national polling that I'm seeing that is made more scientific and takes a bigger sample. But when I talk to Democrats, and this happened in Iowa this past week, and it certainly happened in Colorado this week, it can't get here soon enough for Democrats. Normally in Iowa, people will be like, oh, we're not quite ready for it yet. We know it helps our economy. We know it's kind of fun when the candidates start coming through. But is it starting already? Are you guys here already? You guys meaning members of the media,
right,
like
right.
that. You know, but they're generally, you know, they kind of know that their role as an early state, as the first caucus state, means that with that comes some responsibility as citizens, which is to be at least kind of nice to reporters where they come through maybe do an interview with them if they want to ask you some questions and interrupt your lunch.
Right.
So Democrats seem like really fired up, like it can't get here soon enough. Republicans are like, oh, we just had an election. Really? You know, well, those Democrats are going to be kind of slugging it out. But, you know, you still find strong, very strong support for Trump among Republicans. And you see it break down on those lines, whether or not people are really looking forward to it or not. And it's, I guess that's kind of the obvious answer. And I will tell you, in 2012, when President Obama was running for re-election, it was January. It was this time of year in Iowa, and back then it was Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum, and I think Newt Gingrich was running, and Herman Cain, and I was there this early because Republicans were chomping at the bit and ready to go and ready to find somebody who could, you know, get that Obama guy out of office. So it swings back and forth depending on who the incumbent is and the strength of the incumbent within the party, obviously.
You can follow Don Gonyea on Twitter at DonGonyea. Don Gonyea is a national political correspondent for NPR. I'm not trying to get you in trouble with Iowans with this next question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is it a good thing that the First in the Nation caucus is in Iowa every 4 years, or might it be beneficial if it rotated between Midwestern or Heartland states every 4 years? You know, it's in Iowa, say, every 16 mm-hmm. years, and then in between, it's Minnesota gets a crack and Wisconsin gets a crack. Perhaps Michigan, a state where you used to work, gets a crack. Would that be better?
You know, I am agnostic on that question. And I don't say that just because I've got so many friends I've built up in the state of Iowa and New Hampshire, for that matter, going there all of these years. I always figure my role is to cover the story as it plays out before me. And I let others determine the rules for the actual contest.
Right, the calendar and whatnot.
And I'm a reporter and not a commentator, and I'm not so but I also we're so fixed in the way we have been doing it, whether it's the best way or the worst way to do it, that I'm so focused on the routine that exists in terms of the nominating process that I just confess I haven't spent a lot of time kind of gaming it out. What would happen if, you know, my home state of Michigan went first, or if North Carolina went first instead of on, you think you guys are on Super Tuesday next year, maybe. I do appreciate the notion that you start in a smaller place. Because if you started in, you know, California or Michigan or Florida or in a big state, it's there's such big markets and there's so much money that it takes to kind of get on television and do all of that. I appreciate how a state like Iowa, a state like New Hampshire, lets you kind of ramp up kind of slowly. And it's an easy place to start going to, you know, a year in advance.
Sure.
But I don't know that I'm making an argument.
Sure. No. It certainly it doesn't sound like you are. To follow up on what you just noted, yes, North Carolina is a Super Tuesday state next year. It is, I believe, one of nine. I'm pulling up the list now. Alabama, California, Massachusetts, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Vermont, Virginia, and North Carolina. So, yes, that makes nine. Wanted to pivot as we think about Super Tuesday, we think about next year and that question that I just asked you. And you said something very interesting to me that I had no idea about just a few minutes ago as we were getting ready to record here. And that is that California, as a Super Tuesday state, is actually going to start the election clock, so to speak, before Iowa does next year. Tell the listeners about that.
So I don't have all of these dates like burned into my brain. So
that's okay. You're forgiven.
A bit of slack on it. But California is usually like last, and as such, they almost never count or never have an impact on the result, because it's generally pretty much settled by the time it gets there. I mean, I think in now almost 20 years of covering presidential campaigns full time, I think I've only made one kind of week-long reporting trip to California during primary season. And that was in 2008 with Obama versus Hillary Clinton, the first election when they went up against one another, first election for Obama. And I remember looking around going, wow, I'm in California. I don't know anything about this place when it comes to covering a primary, because there's never been a need before. And of course, we all know that Obama, you know, ultimately kind of still kind of cruised to that nomination that year, even though it was very, very, very hard fought. So here's the deal this year, and it gets back to that discussion of Iowa being first.
Right, exactly.
California having so many votes and so many delegates and being so important will start early voting about the time of the Iowa caucuses. And somebody did say to me this week in Denison that, you know, California starts voting before us. And I didn't know this was going to come up today, and I haven't had a chance just to fact check that yet. But it's essentially right in there, right?
Right.
So the candidates who would be spending almost all of their time in Iowa and New Hampshire, because New Hampshire is 8 days after Iowa, and then South Carolina comes about, you know, 2 weeks after that. So they make the occasional foray into South Carolina, because that's also really important in different ways for Democrats than it is for Republicans in any given year. But that's important. But they don't make too many trips there until after New Hampshire, just the occasional trip. Now they can't ignore California, because you think about it, there will be thousands and thousands and thousands of early votes being cast, more votes than will be cast in the sum total of the Iowa caucuses in that night, all like in the first week or two alone. And they're going to have to be paying attention to that, and they're going to have to be out there, and they're going to have to be up on television in California. So I don't know how it is going to alter how it feels on the ground in those traditional, you know, sure, early states that are used to having it all to themselves. It's going to change it in some way.
Right. And it's early, but I would also note that I don't think it's going to hurt U.S. Senator Kamala Harris. I don't think.
Right.
I mean, that's to her benefit, maybe to a significant benefit, depending on if she could carry California and by how much, I suppose. But obviously, it's early, and we're speculating here.
That's right. And sometimes if you're a favorite son, favorite daughter in this case, then they kind of discount how well you do there if you do well. But even so, to do well in California, whether you're from there or not, is going to be a really big deal. Now, the catch is we won't quite know for a full month what the result is, because they won't start counting those early ballots, right?
Right, right.
But still, yeah. And then you look at Iowa, and we're probably going to get Senator Amy Klobuchar getting in, any day now, this Sunday perhaps. And being in that neighboring state of Iowa, does she have to win Iowa to be viable? Does she need to have kind of a super great showing there? Otherwise, you know, sending the message that she can't even win in her own neighborhood. So those kinds of calculations will still take place everywhere.
Right. All right. Let's dovetail Klobuchar into, stick with the theme of women on the Democratic side. Back in November, for the first time ever, Iowa elected a congresswoman, and in fact, two women to the U.S. House. Cindy Axney, I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly, Abby Finkenauer. Now, Finkenauer is the second youngest woman, maybe the second youngest member ever in the U.S. House, second only to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She's the youngest. But thinking about Iowa as a bellwether, and the fact that two women were elected to the U.S. House from Iowa for the first time ever, I'm interested just in what you made of that back in November, and or if that still is having any effect on, you know, just your thoughts looking ahead to 2020. Does that signal anything to you? Is it significant or not so much?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to read too much into it, but it was a great year for women candidates, especially on the Democratic side, obviously, and also especially in Iowa. And I think it says that Iowa was very much a part of that. Now, at the same time, you know, Iowa also has a woman in the governor's office. And, you know, she took over. It's Kim Reynolds. She took over when Governor Branstad became the ambassador to China. So as lieutenant governor, she moved up. You know, she's a Republican. And then she won re-election. And Joni Ernst, Republican, also is a senator, a U.S. senator, up for re-election in 2020. So, but Ernst was the first female elected to statewide office ever in the state of Iowa. And then we follow it up with the, you know, two congresspersons, and then the fact that the governor is there, suddenly kind of most of the big positions in the state are held by women. And, you know, we'll see what that ultimately means in terms of policy, but it's, you know, it's two Republicans, two Democrats. The diversity we've always seen in Iowa in terms of their federal delegation has been that for many years they had Tom Harkin, the liberal Democrat, as a U.S. senator, and Chuck Grassley, the conservative Republican, as a U.S. senator. So that was evenly divided. And then for the long time, they had two Democratic members of Congress and two Republican members of Congress. You know, so it was a pretty even split. Lately, it is skewed more toward the Republicans. Before, we had this, you know, this kind of swing back, but Grassley, of course, is still there with Joni Ernst, so both their U.S. senators are Republican. But the fact that you do have this kind of core of women is I think more than symbolic, and I think it says something about this state that traditionally has not looked like this in terms of the makeup of its delegation.
Don Gagne, NPR national political correspondent, chatting with us here on the WNC Politics podcast. As we tend to do, we're going to try to tick through some a little bit more rapid fire here before we send you on your way. Virginia, I would classify it as a blank show that has played out this week. I would have to bleep myself if I said that, but it's been an absolute mess in our neighboring Commonwealth. I'm not even going to ask you about Virginia specifically, because who knows what's going to change by the time this goes up. I'm going to ask you instead, what's the craziest scandal, political scandal, that you've ever reported on?
Let's see. I mean, here, they sound so mild. I did report, you know, on...
You must have reported on John Edwards ever?
I did report on John Edwards, and that one is probably it. That is probably the one.
How many states have you not reported from?
I've been in every state.
All 50?
I've been in all 50. I will tell you that I checked off Wyoming as my last state about a year and a half ago, and I didn't do any reporting from there. I went there to visit our member station and to...
Okay. All right. We'll let it count. In Cheyenne or in Laramie?
It was in Jackson Hole.
Jackson Hole, okay.
It was a very nice station event I attended, and what a way to check off my 50th state.
But that's pretty good.
Yeah, and the ones that it takes longer for people to hit. You know, I covered a special congressional election in Montana, and I covered, you know, and I went across Montana with candidate Obama back in 2008, and Alaska, we stopped there with President Bush on our way to Asia for a trip, but he stopped at the military base there and did an event, and I filed on the event before we got back on the plane and left. And then Hawaii, I hit on a similar trip, and it might have been that same trip, but we stopped on the way home, and I filed some stories from there. So I've hit all 50 states, and I think it's fair to say I've reported from pretty much all of them, except for that one Wyoming pleasure trip.
Okay. 52 weeks in 2020, how many of them will you spend at home in the district?
That's a good question. How many weeks are we in? We're in our fifth week.
Well, so we can do 19 or 20. Here in 2019, we're in the fifth week.
Here's the thing. Already started.
Right.
I'm already in 2020.
Here's probably the easier way to do the math. Of the 5 weeks we've had this year, or maybe it's almost 5 or 6 weeks we've had now in this year, how many weeks have you spent at home?
Only the first week, and that's only because it was the holiday. Yeah, I haven't been gone the whole time, but it's, you know, 3 or 4 days, or this last trip happened to be 8 days.
Right.
I tell people it's usually a trip every week. It's the rare week when I'm not on a reporting trip, but sometimes the trips are 2 or 3 days. They're not usually more than 4 or 5 days. So even in a campaign year, I'm home for, if not the weekend, a weekend, even if it's not Saturday and Sunday.
Gotcha. So. Okay. Best tiny desk concert that you've seen at the Mothership, NPR headquarters?
I'm going to give you two very different ones. I saw John Prine about a year and a half ago, and I'm a big kind of John Prine devotee. But I'm also from Detroit, if people don't know that about me. And George Clinton brought the P-Funk All-Stars into the tiny desk.
Oh, my.
And there must have been, you know, 15 or 20 people behind that desk. And it was just some great, noisy, loud Detroit funk and soul with George Clinton, you know, as the holding court in front. And he couldn't have been nicer. So those are the two. It's a pretty special thing to hear that announcement that the Tiny Desk concert's about to begin. Come on over to the fourth floor, because it's only about 100 steps from my desk when I am at NPR. So,
favorite Michigan sports team?
Oh, Tigers. Definitely the Tigers, yeah.
Favorite Tiger of all time?
That's a tough one, but I think it's got to be Willie Horton, who was an outfielder on that 1968 championship team. And he nudges out the great Al Kaline, then in later years, Alan Trammell. So.
And I'm going to show my age here. Is it Denny McClain? Who was the pitcher on that Tigers team from the 60s?
It was Denny McClain. He won 31 games in 1968, but he also went to federal prison.
That's right. So, for racketeering or for money laundering?
It might have been both. He did a couple of stints. Yeah.
There you go.
But he won 31 games one year. I think he won 24 the next. And he was like on his way to the Hall of Fame, but it just fizzled. And I think he was out of baseball by the time he was in his late 20s.
All right. Yes, I was being facetious. That's long before my time, but I pulled that one somewhere out of the hat. Don Gagne can be followed on Twitter at DonGoneya. You, of course, can hear his reporting frequently on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Weekend Edition, and on Here and Now as well. National political correspondent joining us today from Iowa. I appreciate the time. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's been a pleasure. Anytime. Thank you.
And thank you as well for listening. You can subscribe to the WUNC Politics podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher. Stay up to date with what's happening at the North Carolina legislature at our website, wunc.org. For Don, I'm Jeff. Enjoy your weekend. We'll talk to you next week.